комару. Ты душа любезный, совсем не под пару. Ты цветочка кроза родного Кавказа.
Well, hello and welcome to the Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
As you know, the Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and you generous patrons out there who chip in once a month, give us some cash to help us keep this podcast going. So if you like this show, if you appreciate it, invest in it by becoming a patron at patreon.com/Euronaut. Or go to euronaut.org and you can find a link to the Patreon page up there in the right-hand corner. So how are you, Rusana? Another week?
Yeah, chipping away at work. Finally, we have sun in the day.
Good.
Very exciting.
Yes, definitely. So I'm happy to announce that we have another sound submission.
Wow, that's awesome. Let's listen to it.
So this sound submission is from a listener named David Schroeder, and he sent this in. So David tells us that this is a Trabant 601, which he says is the quintessential sound of late communism in East and Central Europe.
Definitely didn't sound like a reliable car.
No, it didn't. It didn't. And he tells us that he was 13 years old in the summer of 1990, and he moved to Budapest with his family because his father got a job there. And the first year he was there, he heard this everywhere, as well as the smell of this car. So it's not just the sound, but also the smell, mm-hmm. which you can imagine.
Yeah, your old grandma's living room.
Yeah, definitely, right? And then, but he says that by the summer of 1991, so a year later, these Trabants were becoming less and less common, and they were being replaced by cars from the West. He spent about 4 years in post-socialist Hungary, but that sound, even though it slowly faded away, will always remind him of the transition of the 1990s. He says it wasn't just a sudden thing that this car sound went away, these cars went away. It's just a gradual fading away. So I thought that's a very nice memory and nice sound that he associated.
Yeah, it always fascinated me how certain sounds and even smells like get stuck in our head. They kind of like get associated with a specific moment in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And then like whenever you smell or hear that again, it kind of like transports you as if in a time machine to that specific moment. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here, to just like maybe play on people's nostalgia or, you know, experience and what these sounds remind you. And hear it clearly for David, I mean, all these years later, it brings him back to those 4 years he spent in Hungary in the 1990s. So it's really great. I also agree that it didn't sound like a reliable car. To me, it sounded like a lawnmower.
Yeah, totally. Or like an old motorbike or something.
Yeah, definitely. So thank you very much, David, for sending that in. And again, for those of you out there, if you have a sound from the present, from the past, from the region we cover, Eurasia writ large, send it in and we'll play it on the show and chat about it and tell us what it means to you. This is becoming a really fun segment.
Yes, one of our most favorite parts of the show.
Yes, yes, definitely, definitely. Okay, so well then why don't we transition to the interview? So this week is an interview that I recorded a few weeks ago with Paula Chan. Paula was here in Pittsburgh for a job interview, but she works on something called the Extraordinary State Commission, which for those of you who don't know, was a commission established by the Soviet government in 1942 to gather evidence and documentation about Nazi war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
I had never heard of this before until several years ago, because a friend of mine was writing his dissertation related to this. It's a fascinating interview about the Holocaust and the Soviet Union, a subject that more and more people are thankfully working on. So why don't you go ahead and introduce Paula for us?
Paula Chen is a postdoctoral research fellow at All Souls College, University of Oxford. Her current book manuscript, Eyes on the Ground, Soviet Investigations of the Nazi Occupation, examines the extraordinary state commission established by Stalin's government in 1942 to gather documentation of Nazi war crimes. Here's Paula Chen.
Well, Paula, it's nice to talk to you. It's nice to have you here in Pittsburgh. It's a pleasure when people come through town and I'm able to talk to them in person rather than through the internet. It always makes for a more enjoyable conversation from my side. But just to start our conversation, I'd like to have you introduce yourself.
Okay. Well, thank you for inviting me. It's an enormous pleasure to be here. So my name is Paula Chan. I'm currently a postdoctoral research fellow at All Souls College, University of Oxford. I defended my dissertation in Russian and Eastern European history at Georgetown University, graduating in May 2023. I am currently working on my first book manuscript titled Eyes on the Ground, Soviet Investigations of the Nazi Occupation, and I'm in the earliest stages of working on a second book project tentatively titled Jewish Choices in Soviet Riga. That's going to be looking at Jews who participated in Soviet investigations of Nazi crimes, became secret associates of Soviet security organs, and then were in turn the subjects of prosecution during anti-Semitic campaigns in Stalin's final years.
Well, I have to say, I had a feeling that you had finished recently because I went to get a copy of your dissertation and it's not online yet. ProQuest hasn't processed it. But you do have a couple of articles that gave me some leads. But what got you interested in researching the Holocaust and the Soviet Union, and particularly these investigative commissions that, from my understanding, I mean, we were speaking before the interview about Jared McBride. You know, I'm friends with him, and the first time I ever heard of these commissions was from him. So they're kind of unknown, I think, in the kind of historical consciousness. So what drew you to them?
It's a bit more of a mercenary beginning than I might have chosen. I went to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and I asked them what collections they had that nobody was working with. And they had first started offering selected duplicates of these materials, copies from Moscow, as early as 1995 on microfilm. But in the past couple of years, 2015, 2016, they had multiplied their collection by 10. These were complete files, not selected reports from this file, that file. But these materials weren't cataloged, and they're still not cataloged. There's no way to know what is there at the museum. So my background is in digital archives. I have a master's in library and information science, and I worked mostly doing digital collections for corporations before I started the doctoral program. So I used to say as an archivist that I can geek out about anything as long as I have enough of it. I worked on banks. I've cataloged gum. I've done all sorts of strange things. So the notion of having 2 terabytes of data that no one had really looked at, the challenge of how do I organize this? How do I index it to be able to understand patterns, divergences across a large body of materials really excited the inner control freak archivist in me. And so I found that using some of this skill set that's dearly won from tedious work in archives over the years has enabled me to tell some really exciting stories.
Again, going back to when I first heard about this extraordinary state commissioned, I was actually surprised that the Soviet government engaged in these investigations, not only at the high state level, but at the very local level. How about you? Were you surprised by the discovery of these materials?
I don't know that I was necessarily surprised because I think of the Soviet Union as a system that relies on mass mobilization. I mean, there's a lot of interesting work done on denunciations and public letter writing in the 1930s. But I did go into it with some stereotypes. I thought that there would be ideological control over the materials. Some of this was derived from the existing scholarship, but also just my stereotypes of the way that the Soviet Union worked. So I thought there would be ideological control over the reporting. And what I found that surprised me is that materials coming in and materials coming out are 2 completely different processes. So it's basically a kitchen sink approach for things coming in. Everything comes in. And then the ideological control occurs at the stage of what comes out in terms of publications and in terms of public statements.
Why would the Stalinist government start a process of investigating Nazi war crimes?
There were a few different concurrent motivations, some of them operating across purposes, but the most basic one was that this was a large swath of Soviet territory over which Stalin's government had virtually no knowledge for a period of ranging from a couple of weeks to several years. Compounding that is that a lot of these territories, like the Baltic countries and like parts of Ukraine, hadn't been Soviet for very long. So the Nazi invasion was really sort of a point on a continuum of crisis rather than some sort of abrupt rupture like what you would see in France, for example. So one of the main motivations was to reestablish control over these populations who had collaborated with the Germans. And then another parallel motivation was to marshal international support. So basically, these investigations started in earnest after the victory in Stalingrad, but a lot of it's directed at encouraging a second front and creating support for the objectives of Stalin's regime for after the war. So let us keep this territory, wartime reparations, new and bigger, better role for the Soviet Union on the world stage. So really showcasing in the most poignant way possible what the Soviet people had suffered, which, as you and most of our listeners are going to know, there's no parallel in other parts of Europe at war.
So what was this extraordinary state commission? What was its goal?
The goals were multiple: to reestablish knowledge over newly liberated populations, to communicate the Soviet experience to the outside world, to create data for wartime reparations in an economic form, to establish who had engaged in illegal activity, anti-Soviet activity, to provide materials for collaboration, also to reintegrate people into the Soviet project in a meaningful way. So what distinguishes the Extraordinary State Commission, and there's no parallel in any other country, in the Soviet Union, there's no non-state alternative.
Right.
There are information gathering projects specifically by Jewish communities that happen in other parts of Europe, but these are non-state endeavors. Mm-hmm. But in the Soviet Union, if you want recourse, you have to go through official channels.
Right.
It's your only option. So you have all sorts of people with very ambivalent attitudes towards Stalin's government. You have Jews who have been technically Soviet citizens for less time than they spent under the Nazi occupation. But if they want justice, if they want to publicize the names of people who tormented them and their family members, Stalin's government is the obvious audience for that, to broadcast those claims and achieve satisfaction.
What did it look like on the ground? In most Stalinist mobilizations, they establish this idea at the top, they create some structures, and then they send down the orders to the ground. And then the people on the ground are kind of left to their devices to figure out, you know, what does the people above us want? And then, of course, I would imagine they have a double problem in the sense that they have to approach or get people to come to them. And I would imagine there's lots of suspicions. So can you speak about, like, how does it work at the local level?
So it is that sort of a term that I use to myself is magical thinking. So you have these orders that are coming out and they're really idealized. They're like, we want forensic experts to supervise all of the excavations and we want everything in triplicate and you have to send all the original documents to us and we want everything corroborated by multiple witnesses and this sort of magical thinking. And then on the ground, you have people saying, we have no paper.
Yeah, I was going to say resources.
We have no electricity. We have no food. And so in this environment, there's this persistent notion of Stalin's government being a system that can maintain control over information. But under these conditions, the people who took charge of these investigations on the ground level were the people who cared the most about them. And so in many cases, that ended up being Jewish survivors. And then in locations such as the Baltic regions, for example, these goals overlapped with those of Soviet security organs. So finding out people who had collaborated, people who had worked in camps, people who had carried out mass shootings, these are anti-Soviet people under the definitions of Stalin's regime. So the conflation of crimes against Jews and other Soviet citizens with crimes against the Soviet state meant that Stalin's government was more committed to tracking down perpetrators than any other country. Mm-hmm. Talking with students, I always tell them to picture, when you think about transitional justice, about reckoning with crimes after mass violence, to think about a Venn diagram. So it's two circles. It's people who want justice, and then it's people who are in a position to pursue it. And in a lot of situations, there's very little overlap between these two groups. But in this particular setting, this particular moment in Soviet history, there was a huge amount of overlap. And so what they were able to accomplish, people on the ground with support in theory, although very rarely support in any material sense of Soviet leaders, in documenting roughly half of the Jews who died during the Holocaust died on Soviet territory. It has no parallel.
Because we also know that there was a filtration process, right? Filtration of Soviet people, Soviet soldiers who are POWs, people who are coming back who are refugees, particularly with those who are under occupation. Is the Extraordinary Commission the main organ that's dealing with this filtration process in general, or is it just one part of that larger effort?
It's one part of the larger effort to understand what happened, understand what people did, understand who's guilty, and sort of a mass immediate post-liberation census, if you will. Mm. But the Extraordinary State Commission auxiliaries and investigators were not the main people who were in charge of filtration. But you will see significant overlap between these investigations and those carried out by Soviet security organs. So in terms of personnel and in terms of documents, in terms of witnesses, significant overlap.
And is this why the documents for this commission are so scattered across several different depositories?
I don't think so. I think that the reason that they're so scattered is because there were multiple stakeholders who were invested in these investigations. So in theory, all of the original materials were supposed to go to Moscow and people could keep copies on the ground. But what you see is that it varies from place to place, but in some locations, there's huge amounts of material, drafts, correspondence, original witness testimonies that were never sent. In some places like Poltava in Ukraine, they sent an initial shipment when they were trying to publish sort of a centralized official report. But after they sent that initial shipment, they kept carrying on investigations for several more months. Mm-hmm. And those materials never made it to Moscow. They're just in Poltava. And it's material that's comparable to what was sent, but it's different stories, it's different people, and it's an absolutely enormous amount of material.
I'd like to get a better picture of what this looked like on the ground. So I'm assuming, and this is just based on knowledge of other types of efforts that the Soviet government takes, they established local commissions. As you said, the people who are participating are those who are actually interested. They want to participate for a variety of reasons. Do investigators say, go out and to these destroyed villages and populations and start asking questions, doing like kind of detective work? Or are people coming to them? Do they set up shop and people who want to give testimonies come to them? How does that relationship work between those giving testimony and investigators?
It varies from place to place. So there were a series of central decrees about how things were supposed to happen, that these lower level auxiliaries were supposed to consist of the respective leaders of the Communist Party, of the state organization, and of the security organs, essentially. It was supposed to be a troika of these three leaders, and they were supposed to oversee the materials. In practice, it varied widely. So in Lviv Oblast, for example, it was the procuracy took control. And this is a situation where one can access through the SBU archives in Kyiv the actual materials from the security organ archives as well. So one can see that it was led by the procuracy. And then in other places, you would have a first wave of investigations carried out by military procurators. And then after that, it would be a small team of women who goes from door to door in a census type fashion. Whom have you lost? What happened? How much money did you lose? So it varies hugely. A major divide that I've been able to find is that in territories that had been Soviets for longer, so since 1917-ish, there was much more widespread participation. Like in Maikop, for example, in Krasnodar Krai, the auxiliary commission held office hours. They advertised it on the radio and in the newspaper. They're like, come see us. Tell us everything that you know. And people were more integrated in state organs. There was more trust. There was more understanding of what this type of mass mobilized information gathering entails. There's also recent memories from the repressions of the 1930s that it can be dangerous not to say, if you know your neighbor did something wrong, it's dangerous not to say it. And that's also something that differs from more liberal settings like France. But then in Molotov-Ribbentrop Europe, you have people who the only experience they have with Stalin's government is deeply destructive. There is not that trust. And even I would hypothesize people who perhaps on a personal level were horrified by the crimes that they witnessed, they still don't want to participate in a Soviet project. So in these situations, what one can see is really robust cooperation between security organs and Jews, which has had really destructive consequences in some of these regions by reinforcing the existing stereotype of Judeo-Bolshevism.
Right. Yeah. So what types of testimony did people give? What are some of the themes that you've come across?
People talking about suffering, about what they had witnessed. There's a stereotype in Soviet history that's really persistent that Stalin's government repressed discussion of the Holocaust as such. Mm-hmm. I strongly argue against that. So out of the 27 official reports that the Extraordinary State Commission published in Russian and in English during the war, half of them talk about Jews as victims being targeted for their Jewish identity. And throughout the post-war years, the Soviet government periodically released openly propagandistic pamphlets and newspaper articles talking about Jews being targeted as Jews, broadcast these types of claims in the United States. The Soviet Union was the only country, the only belligerent country for which the Holocaust was usable history. They could talk about Jews being targeted. They had liberated these Jews. They had fought back. They had fought back Hitler's armies. There's also a strong thread of wanting to foster a pan-Soviet wartime experience, absolutely. But when convenient, they marshaled the Holocaust as such, although they didn't use that term. Mm-hmm. But Jews being targeted as victims of fascism, there's very explicit propaganda throughout the post-war years.
Yeah, I mean, this has been my assumption too. And until fairly recently, the last 20 years, more people like yourself are starting to work on the place of the Holocaust in post-war, even wartime Soviet Union, but also post-war Soviet Union. How do you explain this fact that the assumption that the Holocaust was tabooed in the Soviet period, that they just didn't – not only didn't talk about it, they actually didn't even recognize particular Jewish suffering?
I would mostly attribute that to like many of the misconceptions to the Cold War, having only access to anecdotal materials. It's undeniable that propagandistic references to the Holocaust existed alongside official anti-Semitism. So I'm by no means saying that there wasn't anti-Jewish repression, but it happened at the same time as citing crimes against Jews as something that justified the place of the Soviet Union on the world stage. So I think that it can be challenging to think about a country that did so much harm as also having, for its own self-interested motivations, been more at the forefront of being vocal about these types of conversations.
Is there a testimony that has stuck with you? When you want to give an example to somebody of your work or the types of materials, is there a story that has stuck with you this whole time?
I'm not proud of this. I've become kind of steeled and hardened.
Sure, you have to be.
But every now and then, I'll read something that just shatters me, and my poor husband will be trying to live his peaceful computer engineering life, and I won't be able to hold it to myself. One of them that I try not to think about, but it still devastates me, was a woman who had worked in a children's hospital was recounting having been forced to load children into one of those gas vans, so these sort of mobile gas chambers. And she was testifying about how, you know, as she was doing this, they were begging to not go and they were promising that they would be good. And as a mom, I can easily picture that, children thinking that if they could just bargain, you know, we'll be good now. We'll do as we're told. We'll be quiet. Won't you please not put us through this ordeal? So that's still something that I think about sometimes, but I try not to.
I'm sure you've unfortunately been exposed to all sorts of horrific testimonies of people's experience in this conflict. Do they differ, the ones collected by the Extraordinary Commission? You said at the beginning that you were surprised that there wasn't any ideological content in these testimonies, or it was very light if there was some. Did the testimonies differ for those collected in the Extraordinary Commission compared to those, say, collected outside the Soviet Union in terms of, did Soviet citizens frame they're witnessing in narratives that you would recognize as kind of Soviet narratives? Mm-hmm.
So yes, absolutely. People who would testify would situate their experiences within a Soviet worldview. So Jews would sometimes refer to Judeo-Bolshevism. They would say that they were targeted as Jews and as Soviet patriots. people would conflate wartime collaborators with enemies of the Soviet regime from the 1930s. So absolutely trying to create clear categories of victims, heroes, enemies in ways that were legible within Soviet ideological categories. I've worked in a project that I thought was really interesting. So I found French prisoners of war who had been detained in a prisoner of war camp in Lviv Oblast. And their materials are handwritten in French. And so I tracked these men down in France. They had testified as part of a formal project. If you could get designated as a member of the resistance, you were qualified for higher levels of pension, essentially. So I compared their statements that they gave in Ukraine to France. And they're completely different. What they talk about in the Soviet Union, they talk quite a bit about having witnessed the targeting of Jewish populations, witnessing the targeting of Soviet prisoners of war. And they don't talk about any of this in their French testimonies. One of the discrepancies that I found the most shattering was this one man, when he was talking to Soviet investigators and handwriting his own statements, was talking about fighting, you know, with Polish partisans. And he depicts this very much as clear story. We blow up, you know, Nazi infrastructure and we target the Germans. And it's all very in line with a clear wartime narrative. And then when he is writing out his statements trying to get qualified as a member of the resistance, he reveals that he was involved in ethnic cleansing against Ukrainians. And he talks about this very frankly also in a couple of memoirs that he published. He's proud of it. He likens the Polish government in exile with the French government in exile during the war and Ukrainians as in lines basically as representatives of Sovietism. And so he's not shy about it at all. He's like, I destroyed 100 Ukrainian villages. And in his memoir, he's like, I tried not to kill women and children, but war is war.
How do you explain these kind of really divergent testimonies from this one person?
By the all too common human motivation to say whatever it is that's most likely to get the reaction that one wants.
Yeah, yeah, I would imagine. I mean, how does this affect these communities on the ground? So like you have investigators, you have people who are coming forward and saying, that person over there, I saw them do X, Y, and Z. What happens to that person? Here you already have communities that are shattered. And as we know from, say, the repressions in the Soviet Union and denunciation, we know how quickly this can completely destabilize a community, destabilize a family with denunciation. So can you talk about how it affected people on the ground and their communities?
So it, in many cases, a denunciation, sometimes it would have to be made more than once, but it would produce an arrest, often a conviction, in some cases an execution. So there are people who were quite persistent in pursuing some sort of recourse for what they had seen or what they themselves had suffered. It's interesting. There's a case that I talk about often, a woman who initially in Krasnodar Krai initially appealed to the NKVD about a village elder who had worked under the Germans who had escaped punishment. Her initial denunciation, nothing happened. And then she talked to the Krasnodar Krai Auxiliary Commission. They forwarded her statement back to the NKVD. This time the man was arrested. But what's interesting about her statement was that she, among other things, accuses this village elder of having stolen her horses. And that was why she couldn't evacuate. And as we know, it was a source of suspicion if one did not evacuate. Did one want to live under German occupation? Did one welcome the Germans? And so as she's trying to obtain consequences for this man, she's also reinforcing a narrative that excuses her from having lived under occupation. So these motivations, they can overlap.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of how many people were held accountable for participating in collaboration or war crimes through these commissions?
Through the commissions? No, I don't. There are lists. And it varies. In some locations, it was compiled, the lists of people who were accused were compiled by the commissions themselves. In some cases, they were supplied by security organs. But these lists don't distinguish between people who were apprehended and people who were merely accused and they couldn't be found, or perhaps they had died under different circumstances. So I have lists of people who are alleged to be guilty, but there's no way other than a case-by-case basis to understand what actually happened to these folks.
I see. So they didn't do the usual, like, regional or local report, this is how many people, you know, just kind of you, in Soviet documents, you get these charts of numbers of people under certain categories. You haven't seen anything like this.
In some places I have, but they're usually supplied by security organs. And so I would need to find out what actual names that they were talking about and then sort of funnel it out from there.
Going back to the Holocaust, I'm fascinated by the violence against Jews during the war became capital H Holocaust. Now, in my understanding of the narrative of this, it's really after the Eichmann trial in the 60s. But through these commission documents, through the testimonies, do investigators begin to develop a sense that something particular is happening? In terms of violence directly against Jews, do they see and are they starting to develop a sense or a narrative that what we now call the Holocaust was something unique during this war?
So understanding Jews being targeted as Jews as something that was unique happens in some cases, but the understanding of the Holocaust as something singular never really takes shape in the Soviet Union in the same way that you'll see in Western countries for a couple of obvious reasons. First of all, Jews were not the largest victim group in the Soviet Union. That was prisoners of war. And in terms of people who were actually around to testify. So basically an example that I give a lot is that in France, if you're not Jewish and you're not a member of the resistance, the default outcome for you is that you're going to live. You might starve, you might be hungry, you might be compelled to engage in forced labor, you might be humiliated in various ways, and death is always possible. But the default setting is that you're going to live. And that's not true in territories further east, whether you're Jewish or non-Jewish. There were mass killings of Russians, of Ukrainians, less so in regions further west, like the Baltic countries. But these were populations that also suffered terribly. And what one can see in these materials that are created in 1943, 1944, was the sense that Jews were a precursor, that what was happening to Jews was going to be happening to other groups, particularly Russians. And it's not difficult to understand how it might have seemed that way.
I mean, the Nazi rhetoric was annihilationist towards Soviet people in general.
Absolutely. And Jewish testimonies during this time period as well, these people don't always understand what's happening. They certainly understand that their family is dead. They certainly understand that they've suffered egregiously. But the notion that this was something that was widespread, that it was a fundamental particular component of Nazi ideology, understanding that in the immediate post-liberation moment, some people grasped it, but lots of other people didn't.
Mm-hmm. Did you find in testimonies of Jews in particular, particularly if they're older, do they make reference to, say, the mass anti-Jewish violence of the Civil War period, so the late teens, early 20s? Because, you know, some of the research that has come out about pogroms during the Russian Civil War are very much a precursor to what we see during the Holocaust and during World War II. Is there a memory of that past violence as well? And this is just a kind of rekindling or a repeat of it on a grander scale?
So I would file that under the question that you asked before about situating one's experiences within sort of a Sovietized narrative. So there's absolutely that sort of conjuring. There's one testimony that I love where he compares Nazi collaborators literally to Tsarist pogromists, so invoking that sort of negative connotation within Soviet rhetoric. And yes, absolutely drawing parallels between nationalist groups in the Western borderlands and some of their anti-Jewish notions and drawing parallels between that and experiences during the Nazi occupation, and then contrasting that with the anti-Semitic rhetoric of the Soviet Union officially, right? I mean, there was absolutely cultural anti-Semitism, social anti-Semitism. I'm not denying that. But in principle, that was supposed to be a point of departure from the Tsarist government. It's an idea. It differs from practice, but the idea matters in and of itself.
Right. So what happens with this commission? When does it end? When does it wrap up its investigations? And what happens with all of this material and memory? Is it filed away? Does it create a particular Soviet memory of the Holocaust?
So There was a major official report that was published in Russian and English in September 1945 that was a summary of all of the economic damage. So it's like, this is all of the industry, that was all of the agriculture that we lost. These are our reparation claims. And there was a summary official report prepared about violent crimes as well, but it was never published. There were a couple of official reports after that were about camps in Germany and Poland. So these materials serve as the core of the Soviet case at Nuremberg. Okay. You have some archivists and some investigators from the Central Extraordinary State Commission's personnel physically made the trip to the Palace of Justice. After Nuremberg, when the International Military Tribunal started publishing documents that had been submitted to the court, by that point, so this is 47, there was already enough of a divergence between aligning with an Iron Curtain that there are no Russian language materials that appear in these volumes. And there's an editor's note on one of the early pages of volume 26 or something where it's like, because of the absence of a Soviet editorial staff, these volumes do not include any Russian language materials. So the Extraordinary State Commission documents are not in there. What you can see throughout the post-war decades is that during the investigations that actually happened during the war, it's a phenomenon that I usually refer to as rule by no one. So basically, nobody knew what the other than basic Soviet Union good, Nazi Germany bad, but really the explanation, the story of the war had not coalesced at that point. So you'll have reports that are very, very explicit about the targeting of Jews. And then you'll have another one where they could have talked about Jews and they don't mention them at all. And then you'll go back again. But these stories after the war then are frozen into place. So the official report on Kyiv is a notorious one because we know from procedural documentation that the references to Jewish victims at Babyn Yar were edited out. But then the Lviv Oblast official report couldn't be more explicit about the targeting of Jews. And this is something that happens at the level of Moscow, inserting testimonies specifically from the French prisoners of war. So trying to conjure that sort of foreign international prestige, talking about how Jews were treated worse than cattle, actually inserting the word Jews into someone's testimony where it's clear that he's talking about Jews, but he doesn't say it. And so just to be clear, the editor inserts the word Jews. And then if you look at post-war publications, there's always Jews in the talking about Lviv Oblast, and there's never Jews talking about Kyiv Oblast. Mm. So these documents in and of themselves become authorities. They were published and referred to periodically as the sort of the quintessential official story of Nazi crimes. What's really interesting now today is that people in the Western borderlands – so when I was doing research, I had archivists in Kyiv and Riga sit me down at the beginning saying, you know, young lady, just so you know, these documents are all falsified. Mm. I'm like, oh, I know. But in Russia, even before the war, they tend to be treated as indisputable facts, so factology. There's a huge amount of scholarship where it's people writing these shortish articles of 5 to 7 pages, delineating what happens in a specific place. And there's very little consideration of actually how these materials were created. It's like, well, this is what happened. These are the numbers. This is the sequence. And they're just treated as authorities. And so that divide in war memory is really fascinating to behold.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the way this plays, and particularly how big war memory is in the region by all states and the former Soviet Union. But before that, I want to have you put your archivist hat back on, if it ever came off, and ask you, so these documents are in archives in the former Soviet Union. How did they get to, say, Washington? I'm assuming Yad Vashem. What is the process of having these documents microfilmed or and brought to archives outside of Russia?
So the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum during the early years after the Soviet collapse had a variety of different people who carried out surveys, essentially. So going through materials, noting which files are useful for understanding of Jews. In some cases, these then produced duplicates, but the Holocaust Museum also has surveys of places that they were never able to do duplicates, either because it was just too expensive or just administratively it was too complicated. But when I was doing my fieldwork, I was then able to use these surveys to understand which collections, which files within those collections were going to be the most useful. Having talked to some of the people there who have the most institutional knowledge, I've heard that it was very much like an ad hoc Wild West type situation that trying to copy documents, you know, just as soon as you get there, there would be these arbitrary rules that you can only take like 75% of the file or something. And so the materials that are in Washington, they're a boon for researchers, but they also need to be problematized because it'll be just the report that talks about Jews in this file and then not all the other reports. In extreme cases, it will be only the pages of a report that talks about Jews. And this is important, but I think that's contributed to the notion of the Soviet Union repressing information on Jews. Because if the only part of the file that you have, it's these few pages that talk about Jews and you don't know what all of the other reports say, then of course it's going to seem like what ended up coming out publicly was not doing justice to this limited.
So what you're saying is the actual like trying to duplicate and collect these documents also has implications on how researchers address these documents, how they deal with them.
Right. So it creates a new story. So it's the choice that and archivists know themselves when you're cataloging the physical paper, what you choose, which order, what you preserve, you're making a choice and you're telling a story right there. And researchers at the Holocaust Memorial Museum absolutely understand that this was far from ideal, right? It was driven by price. It was driven by limitations. So that was what was driving the push to copy entire files in 2015 and 2016. So the goal for that was to copy all of the files in Moscow, in Garf, that referred to violent crimes, not just Jews, prisoners of war, deportations. But then the issue there is that these files, and they do in general, you'll find human error where, you know, it's pages missing or just bad images or things like that. But these are rare divergences. But the issue there is that these copies are just the end products of the investigation. So they are the findings and the source material. But what has not been copied are the procedural materials.
And these are very local.
They're local, but there are also many, many files in Moscow where it's correspondence, it's drafts, it's critiques where you have investigators in Moscow looking at these reports from the local level being like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, you have no witnesses. Where is this coming from? Like, who did this excavation? This is worthless. It's not legal. It's not official. Do it again. Oftentimes, it was never done again. But that procedural information that is a vital lens for understanding how these materials were actually created, that's completely missing.
And on this issue of historical memory that you've already hinted at already, are these documents part or included in the memory wars around World War II? Or are they not? And if not, then why?
So yes, they absolutely are mostly emanating out of the Russian Federation. So beginning in the mid-2000s, originally as part of paper volumes, in recent years, and this is something that I have an article hopefully coming out as part of a special issue on digital humanities and the Holocaust in the semi-near future. So in mid-2000s, there were these volumes that came out of the Russian Federation that were – there was one volume for each Baltic country. But it was documents showing widespread Baltic collaboration, very, very explicit about the targeting of Jews. If you match them up with the original materials, they're not doctored in any way. The issue is that they're selective,
yes,
right? So it's these files from that. And a lot of them, the Extraordinary State Commission materials, I can match them up, right? And I can go like, all right, it's the first report and the fifth report and the seventh report. But a lot of these come from central FSB archives that we don't have that knowledge. So we don't know how this relates to the broader collection. But they're clearly trying to draw a straight line between Nazi collaboration and a supposed resurgence of neo-fascist sentiments in this part of the world. And then in recent years, beginning in 2020, and it's continued to escalate, there's been widespread publication online of these documents. So there are a couple of different digital projects of publishing materials online. They're blatantly propagandistic, you know, saying, oh, Ukrainian nationalists, they were evil then, they're evil now.
Yeah, see?
So this is my straight line between the past and present. But ironically, it has become in a lot of ways easier to study these topics now because there's just been more and more material declassified and put online. I've been really shocked about – I recently asked for permission from Garf to publish a couple of photographs for an article I'm trying to get out there about Katyn. Mm. And I thought it was a non-starter in the current political environment. Right. The word Katyn is in the title. I was like, let me publish these pictures in this English language American journal, please. They very professionally wrote back to confirm, and then they gave me permission like 6 weeks later. It was actually easier to get permission from them than it has been with some U.S. repositories. I mean, that's one of the many reasons that the war in Ukraine right now is so shocking and so heartbreaking, because my experience as someone who works on the war, works on war crimes, I've always had very good relationships, very good experiences talking to Russian researchers, even when our politics are quite different and we might not agree on anything else. We agree on the fact that there was enormous suffering, that there has not been nearly enough attention paid to what people went through, what they did, how they tried to reckon with it in the broader sort of international read, Western-driven story of World War II.
And finally, how has this research that you've done, you've been kind of immersed in, changed or contributed to your understanding of Holocaust? Because this is such a massive historical event, if we can call it that, that you can look at so many angles, and so much literature has been published. How does this story that you've researched fit into your understanding? Has it changed? Does it just complement?
I think I had, when I started my research, maybe a more traditional idea of the Holocaust as Jewish history, as something that happened to Jews that one needed to remember to make sure that, you know, never again, that kind of thing. And over the years, having spent so much time with these materials and these stories, I no longer think of the genocide as Jewish history. I think of it as Soviet history. And I would extrapolate from that to other European countries. I think the notion that the Holocaust was something that happened to Jews is really misleading. This was something that happened to societies. And it can be more obscure in places like France, where you had Jews who were basically shipped off and killed out of sight, right? Everybody was implicated in one way or another. It was neighbors. It was people who felt heartbroken but felt they couldn't say anything. People who didn't want to support it but still didn't deny any sort of benefit that might have come their way in the form of property, in the form of an apartment. So these are crimes that targeted Jews, but they shaped societies. And I think it's important, especially as we become more and more removed from these events, not to conceive of the Holocaust as something unique, something that happened in a specific time and place to this group, but rather something that occurred on a society-wide level and influenced everybody. To think of it as broader history and something that, if we're going to understand the way that these communities and have taken shape in the decades since, that we need to account for on a broader scale.
This, of course, leads me to another question, and that is, do you feel then, given that, I mean, I think that's a really interesting way to look at it, is this happened to societies. If we want to write a history of the post-war of this region, right, whether it's Western Ukraine or anywhere the Holocaust occurred in Soviet space, must it account for the reverberations of this violence on the populations there in terms of how they contend with it, how they remember it, how they go on after it?
Yes, absolutely. Something that I think really understood the value of in the later stages of my dissertation research, but I'm applying more vigorously to my second project, but the social network analysis. Mm-hmm. And so what I find valuable about that is that the tracking information, tracking relationships as something that's concrete, but then also viewing the absence of a transfer, the absence of a relationship as a phenomenon in and of itself that you need to be mindful of and to understand the influence of. So these communities then being absent of Jews, it completely shapes the post-war trajectory. It shapes the distribution of property. It shapes economic choices. It shapes what kinds of stories are told and not told. The phenomenon of people who it was the people who were surviving so that were able to tell stories about Ukrainian deportations and maybe not about the family where there were absolutely no survivors. It's, as Timothy Snyder has shown in Bloodlands so well, we associate collectively Auschwitz with the Holocaust because there were so many survivors, right, even though numerically it's a minority experience. It's a significant one, but it's a minority. So, yes, absolutely. Being able to understand the reverberations, the consequences of information that moved and didn't move, the lasting implications of people who weren't there, and how that empty space then determines the course of the future.
That was Paula Chan. Paula Chan is a postdoctoral research fellow at All Souls College, University of Oxford. Her current book manuscript, Eyes on the Ground, Soviet Investigations of the Nazi Occupation, examines the Extraordinary State Commission established by Stalin's government in 1942 to gather documentation of Nazi war crimes.
Thank you very much, Rusana. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
This episode, as all our episodes, was edited and mixed by Daniel Cooper at Podcuts Editing. If you need some audio services, Daniel is your man. Check him out at podcutsediting.com, and he will give you your first edit free of charge. And as always, the Eurasian Knots is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and listeners just like you. Help us spread the word by sharing the show on social media. Tell your friends, family, and anyone who will listen to check it out. And if you like this show and you listen to it regularly, consider becoming a patron to let us know how much you appreciate it and also invest in this show so we can keep it going. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye. Точить кинжалы, а потом ее встретим, чтоб не убежали.